will have an amazing Tuesday.
This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told world leaders they must cooperate or perish. Speaking Monday at the annual climate summit in Egypt, Guterres pointed to the United States and China, calling on the two biggest polluting countries to work together for a world solidarity pact on climate issues.
Humanity has a choice, cooperate or perish. It is either a climate solidarity pact or a collective suicide pact.
More than 100 world leaders will discuss a worsening problem that scientists call Earth's biggest challenge, yet observers say it will be hard to make progress because all the other things happening in the world. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Monday that Donetsk region in the east remained the epicenter of fighting in the conflict, with hundreds of Russians being killed every day.
Донеччина залишається епіцентром найбільшого божевілля окупантів.
Citing the use of missiles, aviation, and multiple launch rocket systems, Zelensky said more than 50 settlements across Ukraine had been hit on Monday, including Zaporizhia and the Kherson region in the country's east. Zelensky also added Ukrainian forces are still in a state of active defense, but are gradually pushing Russian troops back. Russian-appointed authorities in the occupied Ukrainian city of Kherson say power is being partially restored following what they have called a Ukrainian terrorist attack on power lines. The southern city was cut off from power and water supplies on Sunday, after three power lines were damaged in the region that Moscow illegally annexed in September. This is VOA News. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan says a protest march toward the capital will resume this week after being suspended after he was wounded by a gunshot in an apparent attempt on his life. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Sitting in a wheelchair, his right leg bandaged and elevated, Khan repeated his demand for a probe into the shooting and the resignation of three powerful personalities in the government and the military, whom he alleges were involved in staging the attack on him. Khan's protest march to demand early elections was peaceful until Thursday's attack. To be resumed on Tuesday, convoys from other parts of the country are expected to join the rally, eventually lead the sea of people toward Islamabad. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Sri Lanka's Navy says about 300 suspected migrants have been rescued by Singapore authorities after their boat started sinking. A Navy spokesperson says a Sri Lankan citizen on the boat contacted the Navy Monday and said they were in distress. The spokesperson says Singapore authorities later notified Sri Lanka the people on board the boat had been rescued and are heading to Vietnam. A cargo capsule ran into trouble with a solar panel after liftoff to the International Space Station Monday. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
3, 2, 1.
Only one of the two solar panels on the capsule opened successfully following the pre-dawn liftoff from the coast of Virginia. Officials at Northrop Grumman assured NASA that there's enough power from the solar panel for Wednesday's planned space station rendezvous, but the space agency was still assessing the situation. A spokeswoman for NASA admitted it's too early to know whether the spacecraft, which is carrying more than 8,200 pounds of equipment and experiments, would be stable enough to be captured by the space station's robot arm. I'm Shelley Adler.
More than 42 million Americans have cast early ballots ahead of Tuesday's midterm elections, surpassing the numbers from 2018, the U.S. Elections Project said Monday. Americans will go to the polls Tuesday to elect 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, one-third of the Senate, and a host of state and local posts. Most of the 50 U.S. states allow voters to cast ballots early, either in person or by mail, a practice which became widespread during the 2020 presidential election, which was held at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Find more on our website, voanews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, November 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chino Dofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, majorities in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate are up for grabs as the nation votes in midterm elections Tuesday.
Democrats currently hold thin margins in Congress, but if history is any indicator, President Joe Biden's party could lose dozens of seats in the House of Representatives and a handful in the Senate.
Ukraine prepares for harsh winter as Russia targets key energy and water infrastructure.
During his evening speech, President Zelensky said that as of Sunday evening, more than 4.5 million consumers were disconnected from the electricity supply in Ukraine.
And North Korea says recent missile tests were a practice to attack South Korea and the U.S. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Tuesday's midterm elections in the United States will determine whether Democrats maintain majorities or if Republicans seize power in the House of Representatives and the Senate, both of which are up for grabs, with some Republican candidates already crying foul on so-called election integrity. Nonpartisan groups are keeping a close eye on the process. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has more.
Tuesday's general election will mark the end of early and in-person ballot casting in the 2022 midterm elections. Democrats currently hold thin margins in Congress, but if history is any indicator, President Joe Biden's party could lose dozens of seats in the House of Representatives and a handful in the Senate, enough to flip control of Congress for the Republican Party. Democrats say the Supreme Court ruling earlier this year overturning a woman's right to an abortion will drive voters to the polls despite rising inflation hurting ordinary Americans. Some Republican candidates have made election integrity a cornerstone of their campaigns, clinging to former President Donald Trump's false claims of a stolen election in 2020. So places like the Carter Center in Atlanta, founded by former President Jimmy Carter and his wife Rosalynn, train nonpartisan observers to monitor elections in Fulton County, Georgia, in a state that has increasingly become one of the tightest races for Senate. Democrat and pastor Raphael Warnock faces Republican and former football player Herschel Walker in the closely watched race. Elsewhere in Pennsylvania, Democrats have seen early leads evaporate as the Senate race between Democrat Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman and celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz, a Trump-backed Republican, is closer than it has been in months. President Biden told reporters in San Diego he's optimistic about Democrats' chances in this election, but Republicans say they see a clear path to victory. The New York Times reports more than 32 million votes had already been cast as of Thursday, some of which can't be counted until after election night. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Thank you, Arash. And Ukraine is facing challenges of being without water and electricity as winter approaches amid Russia targeting of its key infrastructure. Major parts of the country are already under unscheduled power outages for more than a week. And reporter Anna Chanikova updates Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller from Kyiv.
During his evening speech, President Zelensky said that as of Sunday evening, more than 4.5 million consumers were disconnected from the electricity supply in Ukraine, and most of them in Kyiv and Kyiv region. However, he also said that the situation is under control for the moment, and he also said that this stabilization power outages will continue in Kyiv and also in six other regions that suffered the most from Russian attacks on the energy infrastructure. Also, President Zelensky mentioned that the government is getting ready for new massive attacks, and these attacks are expected to be targeting again energy infrastructure. And President Zelensky mentioned that in particularly a sign for this is that actually Russian Federation ordered additional Iranian missiles, and according to the Ukrainian intelligence, they have already received those. So for the moment, this is kind of situation that outages continue. I can say from my own experience that during the weekend, there were less outages in the city of Kyiv than during the week. So on Saturday, my district didn't experience outages, while yesterday it was only one outage instead of three. Today, we already had two outages and one more is expected. So it is difficult. It is risky, of course, but for the moment, it is controlled. The mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, said that Kyiv is getting ready for the worst-case scenario in case there is no electricity, water supply, and telecom connection. He announced the creation of around 1,000 warm-up points around the city, basically huge tents where people can come and warm up. And also he said that in case this worst-case scenario happen, the local government will organize the evacuation of around 3 million people from Kyiv in order to, again, stabilize the situation and make it easier for people. He also encouraged people, those citizens of Kyiv who have a chance to go to the countryside, to Kyiv, to do so if this worst-case scenario actually comes to life. However, he highlighted that for the moment, as of yesterday, it's no reason for panic and it's no reason to consider that worst-case scenario would happen.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller from Kyiv. North Korea says recent missile tests were practiced to attack South Korea and the United States. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
The North's military says its recent barrage of missile tests were practices to mercilessly strike key South Korean and US targets, such as air bases and operation command systems, with a variety of missiles that likely included nuclear-capable weapons. The announcement underscores leader Kim Jong-un's determination not to back down in the face of his rivals' push to expand their military exercises. But some experts say Kim also used the drill as an excuse to modernize his nuclear arsenal and increase his leverage in future dealings with Washington and Seoul. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told countries gathered at the start of the COP27 summit in Egypt on Monday they face a stark choice: work together now to cut emissions or condemn future generations to climate catastrophe. Matthew Laratondo of Reuters reports.
The next big United Nations climate change conference is underway at the Egyptian resort city of Sharm el-Sheikh. With pomp and dramatic music, the event known as COP27 is expected to see 2 weeks of rousing and fiery speeches from a parade of world leaders, but also skepticism that governments still aren't doing anywhere near enough, and this time under distractions such as the war in Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, and energy shortages. This was the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday and former U.S. Vice President Al Gore.
We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator.
We have a credibility problem, all of us. We're talking and we're starting to act, but we're not doing enough.
So far, there have been a number of small developments to watch out of the conference. One, more than 25 countries announced billions more dollars in financing to end deforestation by 2030. Although past progress on that front has been patchy, and the member states involved, who were chaired by the U.S. and Ghana, only represent about 35% of the world's woodlands. Additionally, delegates on Sunday agreed to discuss compensating poor countries for damage already occurring due to climate change, such as this year's catastrophic flooding in Pakistan. It's the first time that such compensation has been placed on the formal agenda at one of these conferences, which have been going on for decades. A recent United Nations report says global emissions are on track to rise 10.6% by 2030 compared to 2010 levels. But scientists say those emissions need to drop 43% by that time to avoid the global warming threshold where risks spin out of control. Some countries, including the U.S. and members of the European Union, are calling to increase fossil fuel supplies to bring down consumer energy prices.
That's Matthew Laratondo of Reuters. World leaders and activists are gathered in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, for the COP27 climate summit. VOA's Heather Murdoch is following the conference, and she spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the messages heard today.
One of the main messages was also, this is the conference where we're going to talk about not what we need to do, not how we need to do it, but when it is going to get done and making it happen.
What were some of the other major issues that were being addressed today?
Another main issue that for the first time has been brought formally into a UN climate conference is that of how wealthy nations should and will support poorer nations in terms of alleviating the suffering of climate disasters going forward. This has long since been an issue. In more than a decade ago, world leaders of wealthy nations said that they planned to, by 2020, raise $100 billion a year to support poor countries in the event of climate disasters. That goal has not even come close to being met. And they say this year we're going to talk seriously about meeting that goal in future, even though the deadline that was originally set has already been passed. So that has been formally brought into the talks, and developing nations leaders have come to the conference with very strong goals in mind to hold the leaders of wealthy countries to account and say this has to happen. It's no longer an option. Another issue that was brought up today that I think is important, it's a more distant problem, but it's a huge problem that will happen and is already starting to happen, which is climate migration. Al Gore, the climate activist and former vice president of the US, talked today about future climate migration, perhaps reaching a billion people by the end of the century. This is an unheard of amount of people on the move. We have such problems in the world right now with refugees and migrants and displaced people all over the world from wars, economic crises, and now climate crises, but it's only going to get much worse. So that's another urgent issue that was brought up today.
What are some of the specific concerns of developing nations, in addition to funding for mitigation and damage control and paying the cost of recovering? What are some of the other concerns right now?
Well, one main concern is preparing for the future because, like, for example, Pakistan is expected to lead the charge in this regard because it's a country that has suffered greatly this year from climate change related disasters with floods. More than 1,700 people died in floods this year in Pakistan, and Pakistanis and developing countries as a whole are talking about needing funds to recover from disasters that have already happened. But at moving forward, they expect more disasters to happen at a larger frequency. So this $100 billion goal, while very ambitious and so far hasn't come close to happening, is actually also concerning because it also is not nearly enough to offset the cost and the damage from the expected climate change-related disasters.
That's VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch in Istanbul speaking with VOA editor Kate Pound-Dawson. Australia will launch a bid with Pacific nations to hold the United Nations Climate Summit in 2026. The current COP27, or Conference of the Parties Climate Summit in Egypt, runs from November 6 to November 18th. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Coal and gas continue to generate much of Australia's electricity, but the recently elected Labor government is seeking to present Australia as a renewable energy powerhouse on the global stage. It wants to co-host COP31, the United Nations Climate Summit in 2026, with its Pacific Island neighbours. Worried by rising sea levels and an increased frequency and severity of tropical storms, regional leaders have said that climate change is an existential threat. Chris Bowen, Australia's Minister for Climate Change and Energy, told a media conference in Sydney Saturday that co-hosting the climate summit would help elevate the case of the Pacific for more climate action. Conservationists have welcomed Australia's bid to co-host the COP31 climate talks, although they insist Canberra should do more now to stop new coal and gas developments. Simon Bradshaw, a projects research director at the Climate Council, a non-profit campaign organisation, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Monday that Labor's climate policies would be received more favourably at the UN meeting in Egypt.
This conference also follows what has been an extraordinary run of climate fuel disasters right around the world. Of course, many Australians have felt this very directly with our ongoing flood situation. And of course, Australia's shown up. It's back in the game, but will be under a lot of pressure, like everyone else, to really step up and do its best.
For the first time, Australia has a legislated target to cut greenhouse gas output. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In other news, Iran's official news agency says the gunman who killed 13 people at a major Shiite shrine last month was a citizen of Tajikistan. Monday's report on IRNA identified the gunman as Soban Komoruni. He died in a hospital in southern Iran after the attack from injuries sustained during his arrest. The report identified the gunman's accomplice as an Afghan citizen and said a third suspect from neighboring Azerbaijan was allegedly the main coordinator of the attack from Iran's capital, Tehran. The militant Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but Iran's government has tried to blame the attack on a large group of peaceful anti-government protests without offering evidence. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Ethiopia's federal government and Tigray regional leaders began meeting in the Kenyan capital Nairobi Monday for talks on an African Union brokered peace deal signed last week in South Africa. The parties are discussing how to implement the deal and get much-needed food and medical aid to areas cut off by 2 years of war. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
Ethiopian government representatives and the leadership of the Tigray People's Liberation Front are meeting to implement the peace agreement that has given Ethiopian civilians trapped in the conflict new hope. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo and Uhuru Kenyatta, former Kenyan president, are chairing the talks. Tigray spokesperson Getachew Reda says implementing the peace agreement will create more opportunities for the country.
There are a number of things that need to be done, which are stipulated in our agreement. The provision of services is one thing. And the more services there are, the more confidence there is, the more communication there is, and the more hope and expectation it instills in the people's mind. And that will further consolidate the peace we are trying to put in place. So, like I said, we are committed to honor the commitments we've made.
The deal calls for an end to the two-year conflict and the delivery of humanitarian assistance to the people in the Tigray region. The Ethiopian government's lead negotiator, Redwan Hussein, said it is a priority to reconnect the Tigray community with the rest of the country.
In the areas also where we had no access, we have to quickly reconnect services, both telecoms, energy, and banking systems. But before that, our people need food first and medicine. And for that, we are trying to expedite.
The war has displaced millions and killed tens of thousands more. The conflict has made it difficult for aid agencies to reach millions in the Tigray region with food and medical supplies. The agreement also calls for the TPLF to lay down its arms in exchange for reintegration and the return of the National Army to the region. Tigray representatives say they have made a painful concession to end the conflict. Obasanjo, the African Union's chief mediator, say the two sides have established a telephone hotline. The hotline will help them monitor the truce and communicate with their forces to stop fighting in case of flare-ups. Kenyatta, a co-mediator of the peace talks, says he expects the ongoing negotiations to end the civil war.
At the conclusion of this process, will be colleagues who will be working together for the betterment of their country, for the betterment of Ethiopia, for the benefit of our region, and ultimately join us all in our struggle to make Africa a better place and to end and silence the guns permanently so that we can focus on the well-being of our people.
The talks are expected to last 3 or 4 days. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA is getting ready to say goodnight to its Mars InSight lander mission. The lander's power continues to drop since its energy-generating solar panels are continuing to be covered with Martian dust. The space agency says that while the mission team is doing what it can to keep the lander operating as long as possible and is taking steps to wrap up the mission, the end is expected to come within the next few weeks. NASA says in a press release that storing its vast collection of valuable data is the most important part of closing the InSight mission. According to the space agency, InSight has provided details about the interior of Mars, its liquid core, the varying subsurface remains of its largely non-existent magnetic field, weather near the lander, and the measurement of numerous quake activity. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hey there, it's Shauna Renee, also known as the Lady DJ, inviting you to join me every Thursday at 10 and 2200 UTC for today's hit countdown. Each week, I count down the top 20 songs in pop music according to Billboard and Rolling Stone magazines, but more importantly, according to you, the VOA listeners. Again, that's Thursdays at 10 and 2200 UTC right here on VOA 1.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis, inviting you to listen every week as a panel of VOA and Washington-based journalists discuss the top domestic and international news stories. With our correspondents and sources from the White House, Capitol Hill, and elsewhere, we will bring you the inside stories from Washington. That's Issues in the News every week on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out VOA Africa for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinonofa in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has demonstrated its commitment to countering systemic corruption and the Russian government's malign influence campaigns in Moldova by imposing sanctions on 9 individuals and 12 entities. The sanctioned individuals and entities include oligarchs widely recognized for capturing and corrupting Moldova's political and economic institutions, and those acting as Russian instruments seeking to manipulate the United States and its allies and partners, including Moldova and Ukraine. These sanctions expose not only Russia's covert strategy in Moldova, but also demonstrate how corruption undermines the rule of law, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson. The Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated Vladimir Plahotniuk, a former government official involved in corruption. Plahotniuk's bribery of law enforcement officials reflected his long-standing efforts to capture and corrupt Moldova's judicial and law enforcement institutions, while using his wealth and political influence to undermine political rivals and rule of law in the country. The State Department imposed visa restrictions on Plahotniuk in January 2020 for his involvement in significant corruption. As part of that action, Plahotniuk and his immediate family members are generally ineligible for entry to the United States. OFAC also designated Ilan Shor, leader of the Shor Party, for being responsible for directly or indirectly engaging in interference in a foreign government election for the benefit of the Russian government. A beneficiary of a large-scale 2014 money laundering scheme related to the theft of $1 billion from Moldovan banks, Shor has worked with other corrupt oligarchs and Moscow-based entities to create political unrest in Moldova and sought to undermine Moldova's bid for EU membership. OFAC designated 7 additional individuals and 12 entities that have been involved in the Kremlin's attempts to interfere in Moldova's elections. Russia has sought to advance its own interests by providing illicit financing, including funds earmarked for bribes and electoral fraud, to support pro-Kremlin political activity in Moldova. According to Undersecretary Nelson, Russian influence operations attempt to exploit weaknesses in target countries in order to destabilize them from within. These designations reaffirm the U.S. commitment to tackling corruption as a first-order national security threat and to promoting accountability for malign actors who seek to undermine Moldova's democratic institutions and elections. The United States will continue to impose costs on those threatening democracy abroad.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.